This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. Washington Wise from Charles Schwab is an original podcast that unpacks the stories making news there. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Biden administration rolls out new tailpipe emission standards for cars and trucks that amount to a mandate to make and sell electric vehicles. It's a de facto phase-out of new gas-powered cars and trucks, whether or not you want to buy those cars and trucks. The proposal will essentially remake the U.S. auto industry if it goes forward, and it promises to become a major fault line in the 2024 presidential campaign. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal Opinion Pages, and I'm here with my colleagues Alicia Finley and Kim Strassel. So tailpipe emission standards, Alicia, Kim, not exactly the stuff typically of gripping political import, but in this case, it really is because this is a big deal. And the Biden administration has finalized its rule. And in case you thought the Biden administration was slowing down on its plans to eliminate fossil fuels, this week showed again that it is moving full speed ahead. Let's listen to Michael Regan, EPA administrator for the administration, put his gloss on the new rule.
Whether it's battery electric, plug-in hybrid, advanced hybrid, or cleaner gasoline vehicles, we understand that consumer choice is paramount. And the timing could not be more perfect. New technologies have been advancing rapidly. Battery costs are declining, consumer interest in EVs is increasing, and industry is investing heavily in the cars of the future. And EPA is not just supporting this momentum, we are providing regulatory certainty for industry innovation. And if history is any indication, we know that strong standards can and will be achieved through American manufacturing and with good-paying American jobs.
All right. Consumer choice paramount. Battery costs falling. Consumer pickup rising. Alicia, what do you make of the administrator's statements?
So there's a lot to unpack here. For one, EVs only make up about or less than 8% of the consumer market right now, and 60% of those are Teslas. So what this new rule would do, it is a de facto EV mandate, despite the administration's trying to convince people otherwise. It would increase the greenhouse gas emissions standard for new cars and trucks from 2027 to 2032. And there'd be a somewhat slower ramp up in the first several years than what it had proposed last spring. But by 2032, 70% of sales de facto must be either EVs or plug-in EVs, which are essentially plug-in hybrids. So only 30% of cars would even potentially be regular hybrids or internal combustion engine cars.
So just so to underscore this point, there'll be choice, but it'll be a really limited choice.
That's exactly right. Instead of mandating consumers buy EVs, which they, by the way, don't have the constitutional authority to do, they're saying, well, you won't really have any other choice because that's all that's going to be available.
It's pretty remarkable. So just to follow up on here, but the Biden administration says, look at all the things we've done for the car makers, and they're on board. Why they support this. So why are they on board?
Oh, they've been taken hostage. I mean, essentially, they've been given these mandates. They've been told, we're going to give you a lot of money. You can either take all the money we give you and say that you're in favor of this, or we can make you do it anyway, and we won't give you any money. That's not much of a choice either. So they have taken up the decision to grab the cheerleaders' pom-poms and suggest this is going to work. And I actually find this a little bit despicable in that if anybody should know how failing a prospect this is, it ought to be the U.S. automakers. Last year, Ford had an operating loss of $4.7 billion on its EV unit. That was a loss of $63,731 per EV. GM had a $2.5 billion loss just this week. We saw the CEO of Hertz step down after what was described as an electric car horror show within that rental outfit.
Because he committed the company to buy all these EVs that the renters don't want.
Nobody would buy. This happened to me, by the way. I went to rent a car on a trip and they were like, here's your EV. I was like, don't give me that key. I will not drive that under any circumstances. So, you know, this was happening everywhere. And there's nothing in the industry to suggest that this is either going to work or be profitable. But right now, with the temptation of those dollars in front of their noses, the car makers are saying fine.
So is this a Faustian bargain for the car makers?
I'll put it this way. I think they're actually hoping for more subsidies to keep flowing and some of these leniency on the way that the tax credits in the IRA are crafted.
This is the Inflation Reduction Act.
It's a $7,500 tax credit. And the conditions on it is that the parts and the battery materials must be made in the U.S. or a country with which we have free trade agreements. And the problem with this, of course, is that right now they aren't. They're mostly made in China. Most of the battery materials and most of the minerals that go into the EVs cannot meet these standards. So actually fewer and fewer cars are going to be eligible for these subsidies in years going forward. So I think there's going to be some, I'm sure, backroom discussions between, if Biden is reelected, between the automakers and the White House about how to expand the subsidies and probably just rewrite the law so that they can qualify.
Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat, who was the key vote Biden needed to pass the Inflation Reduction Act, has been shouting from the rooftops that the administration has already been expanding the terms for which you can get the subsidies, and he wants them limited to the U.S. terms that he said he signed up for in that bill. But the pressure is enormous from the auto companies to wink, wink, and broaden them. And you have to assume that if Biden is reelected, that pressure will ramp up even more, and he'll probably make some accommodation there. Kim, what about the lessons here, if there are any, from other countries? Because we've seen the European, particularly the German EV market, really under pressure from imports from China, to the point where they're now saying, well, we better put tariffs on that. And you've seen the take-up rate in the U.S. and all these countries just isn't what the politicians had promised and hoped for, because, you know, consumers just really aren't all that thrilled with EVs. Now, I don't have anything against EVs. If they're a terrific product, wonderful. People want to buy them, wonderful. What I disagree with from a point of view of public policy is the huge subsidies that are being shoved, but the taxpayer subsidies to pay for them, to help sell them. And then all these rules which limit your choice. So if you want to buy, you know, why can't we just buy the car that we want?
Yeah, I'm with you, by the way. I don't have anything against them either. And indeed, for certain people in certain situations, they may well be the very best type of vehicle they could purchase. But that's actually a very small proportion of people. And in fact, here's what we're seeing. There was a lot of talk last year about the fact that EV sales were higher last year than they had ever been. Yay. But they plateaued in the fourth quarter. And what we're seeing in the United States, which is following the example, as you note, of European countries, is that there's a certain initial take-up audience. And these folks tend to be more affluent. They tend to live in nice weather states, places where EV batteries work at optimum fashion. And those are states like California, Florida, Texas, to a certain degree. They tend to be second cars, not your primary car ownership, and very urbanized. Okay, those people have now bought their EVs. And as Alicia said, it's about 8% of the nation. Everybody else, they are unaffordable. They're not what folks want. They're not what folks need or require to get around longer distances or who live in colder temperatures. You know, some of the lowest take up of EVs in the country are states that are located in the northern geography of the United States, because EVs, as we saw in Chicago, do not work in cold weather. And it's mesmerizing to me that the administration has no answer for the technological question of how you fix any of that. Instead, they're just saying, we're going to demand you do this. And it's going to cause massive havoc and meltdown at some point in the automotive market.
Well, their answer is technology is moving fast. All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll have more on this momentous tailpipe emission rule and its implications politically and economically when we come back.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal Opinion Pages here on our Potomac Watch podcast, and we're really glad to have you here. I'm here with Alicia Finley and Kim Strassel talking about the administration's tailpipe emissions rules. And Alicia, what are the implications for prices here, prices you will pay as a consumer for these vehicles from this de facto mandate?
So that's really an interesting question, because right now the average EV retails for about $50,000, which is about 20% more than a typical gas-powered car. In fact, there were only about two EVs, electric vehicle models, available in December that retailed for less than $40,000. So these really aren't mass market cars.
What are those, Alicia?
That's the Nissan Leaf and Chevy Bolt, and neither are known to be particularly functional, or and when I mean functional, they don't tend to have a long battery range.
They're not as good as Teslas, in other words.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're not known to be as good as Teslas. You know, Chevy or GM would probably push back against that. But in any case, there really aren't at price right now at a point where most consumers can't afford them. The question is, what's going to happen as they have to ramp up the production? And what you're starting to see actually is a pricing war. And by pricing war is like they need to sell these cars because they're mandated to make them. And so they need to sell them to get them off the lots. And so some of them have actually started cutting their prices in order to sell them. But the result of that is they're bleeding money up the wazoo. Ford has been losing about, or last year was losing about $67,000 on each EV sale. I think Rivian at one point was losing over $100,000 on each EV sale. So this just isn't sustainable. And so what is going to happen, and right now you're already seeing this, is that the companies, the traditional automakers, are using their profits from the gas-powered cars to subsidize the EVs. But the problem, of course, is that when they have to ramp up the EV production and reduce their gas-powered production, that cost shift, they're not going to be able to support.
Yeah, that internal subsidy goes away. And we've seen some EV producers that are under increasing pressure, like Fisker Automotive has pared back its production recently and may have some trouble surviving. The General Motors Lordstown EV truck plant closed. So there are some real troubles here. And Kim, that has implications for workers. There have already been job losses at companies that have been trying to make this transition, because if you reduce your gas-powered assembly lines, the workers can't all transfer to EV production lines. And in any event, EVs don't require as many parts as required to go into a gas-powered car. Let's listen to President Biden talk about the new rule.
3 years ago, I set an ambitious target that half of all new cars and trucks sold in 2030 would be zero emission. I brought together America's automakers. I brought together American auto workers. Together, we made historic progress. Hundreds of new expanded factories across the country, hundreds of billions of private investment, and thousands of good-paying union jobs. And it will meet my goal by 2030 and race forward in the years ahead. Today, we're setting new pollution standards for cars and trucks. U.S. workers will lead the world in autos, making clean cars and trucks, each stamped made in America. You have my word.
Well, that music just makes me feel so much better about the new rule. I'm dancing in the auto parking lot, but I was intrigued. The UAW issued a statement on the new greenhouse gas rules, you would expect, but it was loaded with caveats, and even though it endorsed the rule, it was, I would say, intriguing politically. Here's what one of the statements in it. We reject the fear-mongering that says tackling the climate crisis must come at the cost of union jobs. Ambitious and achievable regulations can support both, end quote. But of course, so far, they are not necessarily supporting both.
Look, if I were the UAW right now, I would be furious. This is a president who says that he's the most pro-union president to ever come into the White House. The United Auto Workers has been a core constituency for Democrats for goodness knows how long. And this is throwing them under the bus. And, you know, it was notable the White House is aware that they are playing with a bit of fire here, which is why they made quite a bit of hoo-ha about the fact that they had stepped back a little bit from their original proposal. Now, I will note that it is true that they eased off some of the targets at the front end, and they are instead backloading it so that all of the targets have to be made up in the back end. You're still getting to the same spot in the end. But they essentially, to the extent that they gave something, it was allowing the automakers a few more years to hit some of these targets. It doesn't make a difference. We're talking about a very compressed timeline here. And, you know, the president essentially even had to buy that conflicted statement, Paul. Remember the sight of him walking along the union picket line a couple of months ago to kind of express his support for Sean Fain and the United Auto Workers as they had a standoff with the car makers over a contract. And he's convinced union leadership to stay with him. But I will tell you, I do not think that union rank and file are buying this at all. There's a lot of pressure on the union leadership to push back. And this is a classic case of politics taking precedence over economic reality, which could come back and really hurt the union.
On the merits of this, in terms of the tailpipe emissions rule, remember, this is being sold as a tailpipe emissions rule, right, Alicia? So on the merits, is this actually going to make emissions overall less polluting?
I think you have to consider in the broader context that just it will reduce the, well, EVs don't have tailpipes, first of all. So it will reduce the CO2 emissions from the actual EVs, but it requires loads of energy just to make these cars. And that includes the batteries that go into them, which, is, by the way, is not the most environmentally friendly process because you also need to mine the minerals, which requires loads of energy. And by the way, most of the mining and refining of these minerals is occurring in China. And where does China, how does China produce most of its power? Coal, right? So it's actually probably net increasing carbon emissions. And you also have to obviously factor in the power that it takes to power these batteries. So when people drive, they have to obviously connect to the grid to fuel up. And most of that isn't coming from renewables. It's coming from fossil fuel. So it actually, in addition to the strain that it's imposing on the grid, it's probably going to require a much more, you know, in Kansas, actually, as it turns out, this was, I mean, separate, but that the battery plant and you to produce EVs resulted in a local utility keeping open a coal plant longer. So there's just going to be required a tremendous amount of energy, amount of power to both run the EVs and then create the EVs, which will actually probably result in a net increase in emissions.
We want to take another break and we come back, take this point about power a little bit more, and then talk about the political implications here for the 2024 election when we come back.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Alicia Finley talking about the new EV mandate passed by the administration. And I just want to underscore this point that before the break, Alicia Finley was making, which is that it's going to take an enormous amount of electric power, much more than we have, to power these electric vehicles. And it's not going to be enough to do it with wind or solar or biomass.
It's going to require coal and natural gas plants. And yet you have the administration also pushing its clean power plant for electricity, which essentially uses regulation to force the phase out of fossil fuels. So there's just a contradiction between those kinds of rules. And when you add on all of the electricity that's going to be required for artificial intelligence, and it's going to be enormous, add on the electric cars to the grid, and there's going to be an energy crisis in this country, Kim.
Oh, absolutely. And they're not thinking about this at all. It's remarkable. We've already had different regions of the country suffering blackouts at times, warning that the grid is on the edge. And we haven't really even fully begun to ramp up for some of these electricity sucking computing uses that you are talking about out there. Already, people are seeing this. The average price of charging an electric vehicle in some categories is now significantly higher or somewhat higher than what it would be if you just went and bought traditional gas. So that gets rid of that argument, right? Because that's been their argument too. It's cheaper, but it's not. And then this is the factor that comes in for consumers, right? It's not just the extraordinary high prices up front of buying an electrical vehicle. We know for a fact, we've got numbers showing that the maintenance of EVs is far more costly than gas-powered engines. We know that when you buy one, if you want to charge it in your house, it often requires that you have to rewire your home to manage it. The insurance costs of it are greater. And the new thing people are finding out is that the batteries on electric vehicles, they're only warranted for about 8 years or 10 years or 100,000 miles. 100,000 miles? Okay, so when my battery in my truck goes out, I'm going to shell out maybe $100, $400 to get a new battery. When it dies in your electric vehicle, the average cost is anywhere from $6,500 to $20,000 to get a new battery put into your vehicle. Consumers cannot afford this. And, you know, and that's before, as you say, all of this starts to collide and we potentially have some sort of energy crisis going down the road because of these cars coming on alongside a grid transition that isn't working.
Well, this is going to, looks like this will be a major fault line in the presidential race after the administration rolled out its new tailpipe rule. Donald Trump denounced it, and so did many Republicans. He said, vowed to repeal it on day one. Well, he wouldn't be able to do that, but he could certainly pare it back or attempt to. But I wonder, you have this division between Trump and Biden now on this issue, Alicia. It looks like it's going to be one of the biggest issues in the campaign and could be equivalent of, you know, what normally taxes are in a campaign. Would you agree with that?
I do. And partly it's because of the polling that these mandates are incredibly unpopular. Somebody sent me a poll showing from Michigan showing that nearly 90% of people in Michigan oppose federal government mandating EVs or phase out gas powered cars. And of course, this is why the president is really at pains to say, well, this is not an EV mandate. Well, no, yes, it is. And this is kind of reminiscent of the hullabaloo that happened last year when the Consumer Product Safety Commission floated the idea of banning gas stoves. And then it walked about saying, oh, that's not really what we plan to do. And then accused its opponents of lying because people want choice. This is also becoming a cultural issue.
Yeah, climate is a cultural fault line, not just economic.
Another pattern of the left trying to impose its own supposedly superior moral and enlightened values on the rest of the country.
Kim, I know you've been looking into the politics of this, and I wonder what you think, because in Michigan, for example, where you have so many auto workers and so many people involved in spinoffs from the auto industry in that state, and there are others, Ohio's another one, others, I wonder how this is going to play. I mean, obviously, it plays much better in New York, plays much better in California, on the coasts, but what about the states where this election is likely to be decided, like Michigan?
If you look at a map, it's incredibly clear. Everywhere where EVs are popular and have been taken up are blue cities or areas within red states where there are blue populations, i.e. things that are more urban. So I think there's a couple of things here. There's the overall view on this. And Scott Rasmussen, the pollster, I was actually talking to him in recent days. He actually asked a specific question in a recent poll about this rule. And it reads, government officials are working to develop regulations that would effectively outlaw the manufacture and sale of gasoline-powered cars. Do you favor or oppose? About 34% favored in some capacity, 60% opposed or strongly opposed. And there's a slight majority of Democrats who favor this, but Republicans, 76 were opposed, and independents, 60% were opposed. And it does completely fall across income and geography. So if you're in a big urban blue city, there's about 65% support for this. If you are in a rural area, you are 70% opposed. And I think that gets to Alicia's point about cultural issues. Also, income, the more money you make, the more open you are to this. But you have to get above $150,000 in income for you to begin to get a group of people who think that this is a good idea. That excludes an enormous number of American voters who really hate this idea. That's one issue. The other issue is swing states. And as you just mentioned, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, all very heavily manufacturing oriented. And Donald Trump is already hitting Joe Biden hard on what this is going to do to domestic industries.
So do you think, Kim, just briefly, this is a net plus for Trump?
Oh, I think it's a huge net plus for Trump. I do not think that Biden is really understanding what he's potentially walking into. And it's a characteristic of this administration. They dance to the tune of their well-heeled interest groups, in this case, the climate lobby. And I think at their peril, and it's why you see Joe Biden's poll numbers what they are now.
All right. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Alicia. We shall see how this plays out. It won't be the last time you hear about this debate between now and November. We're here every day on Potomac Watch. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it when you're here. We'll be here tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.